Thursday, September 21st, 2003, and we are convening the
units. We started at least in that south in August of 2019. We're not entering into our fifth year there. We are 100% occupied at South. It is not a RAD TDRA property. It is a tax credit property. All of our residents must meet at or below the 60%. We do serve voucher holders, and we currently have at South 54 voucher holders. The Boys and Girls Club, they do use the community room at Chalmers South. They use it throughout the year, our school year, every week, and then also even during the summertime, they use the space. Of course, once West is open, they'll be relocated to the community room at West. And once they vacate the community room at South, we'll be working with Austin Pathways to see what type of uses we can have for as we move forward. We do have other resident services as well. A few of them I can name. We have healthcare, Central Texas Food Bank. We have Goodwill of Central Texas. We have St. David's voter registration, financial health with Pathways, and then also Health Star Foundation, our student services that serve that from the South. East, at Chalmers East, we have 156 units. We are currently at 99% occupancy. This is going into our third year for Chalmers East. We have 50 project-based vouchers here at East. And then we have a mixture of some units that are the 60% AMI and then a handful of market rate units. Okay. Same resident services that we have at South also function here at East. And then also with the community room here at East, the residents are able to use the space as well. They have had baby showers, birthday parties, and even graduation parties here at East. And we are not without some challenges at the sites. No property is perfect. We have experienced some trouble with staffing, particularly in the maintenance department. But we've got a strong team here, and I think we're going to be all right. We've also had some struggles with vandalism and graffiti. And then there's been some issues with our camera systems. We do have eyes on both South and East where it's at the sea. But there are some upgrades and things that are taking place right now. It's been a little more time consuming than we would have imagined, but we're getting that finished. We do have a courtesy officer that lives on site here at East, Officer Soto. He's with the Austin Police Department. He's been valuable to us. He handles most of our resident complaints and any type of disturbances. He serves at both Traumas East and Traumas South. The residents do have access to him through the phone or email. So it's been a great addition to the team. And then we are definitely excited about Traumas West, which is right around the corner. So we're gearing up for a new lease up. So here, just a few more about. We're hoping within maybe 60 more days, we'll start actually leasing. We have a wait list that we started some months ago. We right now have 498 people on that wait list. And we have applications in hand that we have already started processing.
Yeah, Marlon, let me ask you, how many units would be in Charles?
156 as well.
So we'll have a grand total at the site of 398.
And we started with how many?
158. What is the estimated time of opening West?
Last was maybe that first week of October that we'll start getting some units.
Unfortunately, we got news this morning that's been pushed. We found out that the listings were having some delays with powering up the property. And the latest time we've got is on the press, I don't think the Marley even heard this. We don't expect to have the power until probably the 15th of November. And without power, we can't put in elevators. There are certain things we can't do. So unfortunately, those delays are really hurting us at this point.
So what's the power? What's the delay in the installation?
So I don't want to blame on any one thing, but in this moment, the Austin Energy timelines, we are at, from where we are today, on their regular timelines, 33 business days for them being able to energize a property that, for all intents and purposes, is ready to be energized.
And they have a process that we're doing, mm-hmm. Right? That's just for 1 million.
That's 1 million. That's just the first building.
Okay.
Four.
Yeah. Oh. And we have currently managed Los Energy. Sylvia's been speaking to their leadership. We've been trying to put things off. They have an extra time, but it's become very frustrating for us to delay this experience. We really like it.
It's related to transmission constraints.
No, it's staffing at Los Energy being able to create that. And staffing issues all over. And we've when you all were here for the grand opening, for the announcement about the vouchers, awarding vouchers, and Mayor Watson was here, mm-hmm. We pulled him around the back to show him the healthcare site, the clinic, went without power for more than a year because Austin Energy was ready to go, was ready to be. Mm-hmm. We could have had healthcare there a year earlier, were it not for that, we just couldn't get Austin Energy to power the site. They intervened and got connected with other key folks there. And there was also a transition on Austin Energy. And so we're now talking to some of the top folks. And, November sounds like music like years. There's just some of the other things we can deal with. So they're having a moment at Austin Energy. We don't want to be able to too bad. They've been where they can be good partners. They've tried to be good partners. but it has slowed some things. So we're working through it. And just so it's going to be. It's kind of, our hope is that by the end of the year, we are in a spot where we're able to start seeing that, you know, every building and every unit. We won't be there, but next year, that building is going to be brought to life. I mean, next year, this academic, if you will, that building is going to be brought to life. And the monuments came out a lot to do. The first thing you'll see is the next month and a half or so, we'll get the Boys and Girls Club open across the way. And it's air conditioned now. There's power at that building. So we can go in there and actually see it. Like, yeah. Kind of move here a bit. We can go over and take a quick look at that project. That's progress. Since 2 weeks ago, we took the assistant secretary, and he wasn't air conditioned. So there's progress made. So one down, three buildings to go. We'll film free session tomorrow. Thank you again. We appreciate the partnership.
If I can add,
yeah.
I just wanted to say, a lot of time I'm talking about the business side of it. We think about Chalmers. I came here in 2019, right here in this area. We used an apartment that was to be demolished as the office, and that's where we started processing applications. It's been a really good journey. I've been doing property management now for 26 years. Since 2019 up to now, I've learned more just by the experience of working at Chalmers with the residents. I've met a lot of wonderful people with HACA, with the residents. You know, we've gone through an ice storm, we've gone through COVID, and now somewhat of a heat wave. And it's just been a joy to meet the residents that have need. I never really knew what the need really was concerning those that are elderly, those that are disabled, and those that are in a more lower income bracket, and to see how we're able to serve those residents. It's been a great joy. I remember the very first time I walked into a draft meeting. I didn't even know what a draft meeting was. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, please don't ask me a question. Please don't ask me a question. But I've learned, even on that side, being a property manager, what it takes to even get to the point of being able to hand someone a key. So it's been really good. This is not my going away speech. I wanted to speak to the other side of everything, that every day in the works, it's great being able to serve people.
How do you come along with the research?
Kind of what's kind of rolling around Austin car break-ins, see when they can give someone leak something out. I think that's been the most of what we experienced. We did struggle a bit with the homeless, but we're seeing less and less of that. They're getting into things. And then when we're reaching out to APD, they're coming out just as much as they are coming out to APD. We get a few complaints about smoking weed, selling in the elevator around the property. APD won't come out for that. When we're able to identify what residence it is, then we take the next step for the guilty spot.
Thank you. Thank you for getting the team. We really appreciate you guys.
Present the COA bus report.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. Chair, the meeting was called to order on September 12th at 10:30 a.m. But on the bus, Vice President of the Minutes for the last COA board meeting, Alice McGee, chairs about the Astros. They accept the minutes as good. There was a speech with her. President of the Postal Citywide Board balance is $2,892. Michael Law, household who received utility assistance check payments from HUD, will begin to get those payments into on a debit card beginning January 2024. 2024, advising them of the new process. The new invention installation is information to include many resources of income received in the past year from the lab. Recertification has been delayed. However, once HACCP has been advised by HUD, residents will be notified as well as what new documents may be needed. I'm going to stop there for a minute. I speak a lot of Spanish, so my English is not really, like, perfect. So, I always wanted to say that because I'm always in the Spanish version. So, please, if I pronounce a word that's not correctly, that's because I do a lot of Spanish. The information for the national standards for physical inspection while in October at Lakeside and Booker to Washington, Salina, and Santa Rita will soon follow sometime in 2024. Michael Berger, reconstruction project at Palmer West, my construction delayed. Rosewood currently underway, Santa Rita, conversation with residents. Board meeting Tuesday, on September 21st, 2023, at 12 p.m. at Chalmers East. The Hawaii Viegas, now National Night Out, is on Tuesday, October the 3rd. 23 is a safety and community awareness campaign to foster positive relationships with the police department and fire department, first responders, there will be no company residents, council consultation this year. Encourage resident council officers to chair APD flyer during the resident council meeting and national night out events. This flyer was recreated by APD liaison officer Michael Davis. This flyer will give residents the proper protocol when calling APD, and it reflects the differences between when to call 311 versus 911. Consumer disease control is advising that COVID-19 cases are on the rise. Therefore, they recommend to get vaccinated or booster shot for the new variant. Stay home if you're sick and get vaccinated and masked up. Barbara Jackson, youth education, back to school kickoff program, Boys and Girls Club, Creative Action, Victory Reading, which is an ASB tutoring program, Family Reading Book Club, continue at Santa Rita. Beginning on September 13th, families that participate in the group clubs have the opportunity to win bookshelves. Murphy Rowland Work Development Administrative Assistance Program. There is a lot of interest. However, the priority will be given to parents with children 0 to 12 years because this is a 2-gen program. Simone Bright, Family Self-Sufficient, offers residents the opportunity to achieve self-sufficient by building an escrow savings account. FSS coaches are now enrolling residents at BTW, Chalmers East, Goodridge, Manchester Village 1 and 2, Sherman Heights, Bolden Falls, Chattelman, and Medical. Catherine Trader, Human Inclusion, Lakeside Management, First Pop Up Network, FSS, Affordability Program, which will be $30 for any internet program for $100 off an advanced desktop, laptop, and such. All residents qualified due to those in subscribe.
What was it you said about the computers? Did all the residents receive them?
It looks like she's saying that they will get a $30 off internet program or $100 off a device, which would be like the laptop, a desktop, or a tablet.
Can I see the affordable kind of program? Sorry, not mentioning it. This is a affordable kind of three program that are grant through the FCC. So if they apply for it, they're automatically qualified because they're already living in such a So then they're doing an educational outreach because all of our residents qualify.
Thank you.
Back to Diane Grace.
On Tuesday, September the 12th, 2023, which is 3 sessions of 1 hour class, APAS ownership program introduced and welcome Master of Social Work. Natalie Schwartz will be at Ocapa for the next 2 years and will work with our home program. Keone Williams, new mentor began on Tuesday, September the 12th. Update, Ruben Garcia, Santa Rita High Moms. Sir, Commissioner Lucci. Thank you. I did connect with Gloria Espinosa. I sent her an email. We're going to do a Zoom meeting, and we're going to be working together. Thank you. We're going to take IMOMs to the board. And I also invited Sulita Romero Montal. She came Tuesday to the IMOMs meeting. I'm very impressed with her program. She saw all the, we created a slideshow for her, and we had special guests there speaking and stuff. And so she was very impressed. We're going to also be working with her. And she has invited the IMOMs and myself to go to a resident council meeting and to talk about the IMOMs. And maybe they can get started with the IMOMs in San Antonio. Very impressed. Yeah, very impressed. Very impressed.
Did we have a model that we built and we built our IMOMs program, or is this something that just bubbled up from you and some of the other residents?
It actually started with myself and a couple of the residents, which were the my resident council members. And then we started talking about it, and then I started including other residents in it to see what they thought about the IMOMs. And it was created back in 2021, but we had our first meeting in 2024.
There was not a model.
So the basis is actually from the IDECs, all the programs from the IDECs, you know, really IDECs.
Correct.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. We have like on.
What did you get for?
So it's based from the, we also have IDEDS program, right? We have a grant from that. So we started the fall introducing program, and then now we realized that it would be valuable just to have the women, the grandmothers, and the wives to be part of it. So the, if you're talking about like the basis, we started with IDEDS, now there's IMOMs. But IMOMs has really launched something much bigger now.
She took it to a whole new level.
Yeah, she did. Right.
I mean, in terms of participation,
yes,
temple.
Yes, absolutely.
So, going to that woman's question, when I asked, was there a template, or did somebody develop?
Yes, Men and Me. Men and Me, that's the formative program. That's a national, you know, recognized one. Isaac Rowe is actually the founder of the IDETS program, and he's basically one of the, you know, the founders of it. And we took on to that because we received the grant. The fatherhood grant for, it's like a 5-year grant that does provide the staffing for it. So Keonis Williams, we have an IDETS coordinator on board with Austin Matthews, as well as Murphy Roman, that's with workforce development. So that's sort of, it's a combination of everything, but of course with Lupe's sort of take on the IMOMs, it has really exploded.
Yeah, my own policies. It's resident led, and the way I created it, It kind of goes with IDADs, but at one point we have our own little ideas of how we're going to run the program. So the way we run it is that's why we get so many IMOMs to join. The first time that we had the first meeting was 20 IMOMs joined the first meeting, and then the second meeting it grew. We ended up in March with 40. But in August of this year, we ended up with 54 IMOMs on site. So I bring in speakers and lessons, like classes. And so we raise our own money to pay for our speakers and our class. And then we do a lot of community work. We go to Ronald McDonald's house. We go to nursing homes. We serve seniors here on property. There are seniors. We bring them gift bags, food. We do all that stuff extra that we combine the community with the community with. And I also work with outside communities. It's a little different, but it's something that we work toward. Like I want to go to the border and make sure that kids over there have backpacks, school supplies, coats, and I'm working with sponsors with that already.
It's far less regimented than the IDADS program, which is a program, if you will, that really incorporates, I think, some of the self-help and other elements. It's not quite 12-step, but there's a lot of group conversation and engagement. That happens in IMOMs, too, but the IMOMs locally decide what they want to engage in and how they get back to the community and who they help in the projects that they take on. And it's been an incredibly creative and inventive group of women and work with Mary and other leaders really tapped into some real strengths that, of course, I think all of us know incredibly strong women that are around this table. And so it'd be no surprise that, Lupe would find incredible women in our properties who are doing some great things. It might be worth at the next board meeting or one coming up to have just a briefing on IMOMs.
Okay.
Compare that to IDADS and think about the kind of investment that Hotville Con wants to make an IMOM space. There's a lot of demand for it, and it's clearly something that's, in this case, totally a homegrown kind of thing. It's pretty exciting.
I'm very proud of the program. I think all the IMOMs, they're really out there. I think that the way my whole goal behind this is teaching the IMOMs that they can move forward. It's not just staying at Hoffa because we're having IMOMs and we have a medium grid call. It's all about moving forward, moving to places and getting better jobs and reapplying for homes and they moved out of domestic violence or I have like five, they had a job, now they got better jobs with more pay. And it's all about moving them forward. It's not about staying right here. It's not about my goal. That's my goal. It's moving them forward.
So let's put everything future board meetings. So we'll work that out.
Okay.
I don't want to rush you, but we'll do that. We have
three full
agenda. So go ahead and wrap it up once you want.
Meeting adjourned by Alice McGreek. Guest motion in place and
It's all what is it called?
So Mandy presentation or folder, and it will be her presentation.
Okay. Here, I'll give it right back to you.
We have the board criteria requires a minimum of 1 year performance to show the outcome.
Okay.
So I think we're definitely right for submitting that award with the next cycle.
Okay. Okay.
I'm on it. Sorry. You said with the IDADS program was heavily funded, that it was a grant.
It's a state grant. And so the difference, too, is because we do have grant goals and obligations, we can't quite have the same liberties that the IMOMs have because we do have reporting requirements to the state, making sure that we have the not just the participation, we use submit reports. So it's a grant itself where IMOM doesn't really have to be that. So they have much more liberty to kind of go to the direction that they want.
What agency? What state agency?
Department of Health. This is the Department of Health, yes.
Yes.
Other legal services.
Thank you.
Cool.
So we'll let her, thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
So I think we're going to turn to Citizens Communications and we're going to
let's go with Veronica first.
Oh, okay.
And then
yeah, she's back here.
Okay, let's do this
together.
Veronica, you want to
speak?
Well, I'm
Because I mean, if she didn't want to be responding, you know, it's so what I want to do is I want to
and apologies. I was having some serious technical issues. There it is.
That one. So you're not this one.
Yeah. Not that one.
Veronica Castillo Perez, the president of the Residents Council.
Perfect.
And I wanted to thank all of
thank
you for being on the commission. I know I've been on the board of the commission before. So I know the commitment and time that it takes some crucial time. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you. Wonderful housing.
So, the same agenda is to approve the board minutes from August 17th to 23. Does anyone have any amendments, corrections to the minutes? If not, I'll take a motion to approve the minutes. Motion by Commissioner Costello, seconded by Commissioner Carrington. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
To be opposed, hearing none, the motion carries. And Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you for this opportunity. Again, I love this with the Community Master Network, and this is my annual check-in, so let y'all know what we're up to and to learn. Every meeting I go to, it's like, what's the amazing things that are happening, right? So kudos to y'all for all the incredible impact and outcomes. A couple of things I want to highlight, of course, is, you know, Andrew has been around for about 30 years. And I believe I've been at ED for 8 years. I'm like, how did that happen? But as you know, we have a quite a variety of member organizations. Let me see on the flyer. And it started off small, but we're up to 25 partners. And again, a lot of it is how do we align efforts, how do we leverage resources and through collaboration, right? Try to have a bigger impact. The backside of this flyer tells you a little more about our current initiatives. Blue and white, our patented new dots. It's actually not that. But I did want to share a couple of new tools. I think last time I came, we were. We have just published our race equity action framework, so we do trainings around that framework for free twice a year. We have a session coming up in October. And then earlier this year, we published 6 community resource guides in 10 different languages, you know, really targeting some intervention refugees for more basic health and safety, like around the pandemic, right? You know, people were looking for health and safety information. So we have those available. And I'll talk a little bit about the mental health toolkit we're about to publish. But you see the dashboard, that's something we're kind of known for. And this is just a high level version. I've never done a dashboard presentation in 3 minutes, you know, I'm saying it in 15 minutes, but this is just a real high level summary of the main indicators. Each of these indicators on our website has a drill down to 4 or 5 different ways of kind of disaggregating these things. And the things that stand out, of course, you know, affordability and economics, because of Austin, the engine that we have, right, presents a lot of positive things around it, but also some challenges with it. And so we do have a pretty high percentage of individuals for housing poverty, very housing poverty, like 50% of their income on housing. But on the health side, we see some real challenges. You know, some of the worst trends that we see is around mental health and obesity. So definitely things to kind of keep an eye on and try to focus on. And we keep coming out of the pandemic, there would be kind of some mental health challenges just based on that sort of collective trauma that we all experience. And we have a language access action team. And so they wanted to take on the issue of mental health for non-English speakers. And so this other thing that's here is in, it's a It should have a big old draft on it, because it'll be published in mid-October, just building a website for it. It's really a mental health toolkit we created and expanded. And so instead of creating it in English and then translating it, we'll create it in Spanish and then translating it back to English, which is why our tagline is just again, familia también. It flows a lot better in Spanish than if I will pay my family. But it's still a powerful message. But so anyway, partly I wanted to share that just because once we publish it, we're also going to do the social media awareness campaign year long around some of the schools. And of course, do some awareness raising sessions. So if you wanted us to come and present to different groups, right, and different complexes, we'll be happy to do that. Again, the speaker and I were kind of focusing on the non-English speakers, but of course, it's useful information for all of us because the stigma around mental health doesn't just affect any one community or any one language community. So we're excited to launch that. It takes us a good while through the collaborative process to agree on what such a should look like, but there's been already a lot of excitement around this, and again, happy to come back and talk a little more about it another time, but thanks for your time and all the wonderful work that you all have done.
We would love to do more with CAN. If you're a bunch of board CAN and why don't we get into those calendars and try to visit? And if I'm on, I'd love to kind of look through pathways and see what properties we can get you to visit with different president leaders, of course, or CY advisory board. Those are the president and vice presidents of every property. We can actually, where it might make most sense to go and have the deepest impact. The other thing that occurs to me here, Roel, is that we have our first on-site healthcare clinic over at right over there. And we're excited about that. And maybe just have here with Sarah with a friend Sarah and at community care as well.
Yeah, I think we're trying to pair the awareness campaign year long social media awareness with periodic wellness fairs and things like that. So there never fair you all want to host or want to help support, and how do we combine the different folks? They're not going to go to, and everyone's going to go to a training, right? So I need to create other opportunities for folks to get the information and help the folks on overall well being and wellness.
We have partners that provide services with their peers of residents, so I think that would be a great training opportunity for community health workers.
Yeah, the more, again, part of it is how do we address the stigma and make ourselves more comfortable talking about these issues, which is easier said than done, but I think it's been exciting. The response has been fantastic, even though we haven't published anything yet, but we have a lot of community folks that put some input into creating the tool, so that's why I think it's been helpful to have them also as advocates for our work.
Maybe to help us get us all together.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming.
So that's it.
Was this formerly the community?
Yes, it was. Yeah, this was
those of us who've been around a while.
My grandmother had it. It was Community Action Network, and somebody incorporated it as Community Action Network, so we have to rebrand. I kind of like advanced action with direction and not just action for the sake of action. So I'm very close to being able to do a DBA on that. So and we still don't have to lock that.
Good to see you.
Appreciate you.
So we're going to turn to the next item. Before we do, maybe I'm just going to jump to that seat there. And everyone else's staff team, which is amazing, but we're joined by Janeway again from the Travis County Housing Authority. Well, Janeway, want to come up here and look? We'll still notice when you sneak out after it. So we're turning to item number two under the action items, which is an update on AHC's acquisition development program and a discussion on Austin's real estate market. You all had asked for a briefing as we proceed with different transactions. You want to have a broader sense, yes, so that we can pull up and take the 10,000-foot view of what's really happening here in Austin, and also even going higher than that, looking at what's happening nationally. I just want to reasons to be concerned. Supply chain issues, slowdowns in the economy, challenges in labor markets, all of which affect us in Austin, oftentimes in reverse ways. It seems like we're immune from certain forces and benefit from other things. And, it's things that you think would happen one way don't seem to be happening. But right now, the city of Austin is under an incredible amount of pressure and challenge to do the right thing. And Andy Command, who's the deputy director of the city housing department, is right in the center of all of that. Andy and I have been for a long time, including starting to use the executive director of housing works for quite a while. You've been with the city for 5 years, so.
6 years.
6 years.
But it's kind of like dog years, you know, it's
yeah.
Like 60 years.
And Bessalar has been a friend for many years, served on the city planning commission, and has been a colleague of the health work, worked at work for many years, PhD student, Texas, and you're out there with Mr. Mueller, PhD students, and then there would be amazing things that for him to continue to work in the health policy space. But he is in. Tell me if you work up with the board you're on here.
I'm on the planning commission. I'm on the Project Connect Lead by the Austin Economic Development Corporation Board. And I was very sad to see a bunch of other things that won't go into.
He's got some jobs. Yes.
Everywhere. I walk into meetings and it's like, this is there.
And
Ashboy. So it's 14 months to get this scheduled. So we're glad you're finally here. And but take away, you're going to provide an overview to the board about things that they should be thinking about.
I am. I think I'm going to go first, and I'm going to pass it off to Aves. I did want to say that I ran over here in my car. UT, because I was just with the city of Charleston. It was their chamber, the interstate visit. Talking about affordable housing, of course, I was leading a panel discussion. And what was so interesting to me is we don't have exactly, we can just take Charleston and insert Austin, but we all have the exact. So today I was going to talk briefly. So you can go to the next slide, but I'm in control. About our strategic housing blueprint, and then more broadly, just about some of the challenges we're facing and some of the solutions, and where we see PACA and AAHC fitting in. I always like, well, I have mixed feelings about this slide. I don't like the data that it shows, but it is pretty extraordinary to look at the city of Austin and our wages. Which is the green line, again, relatively flat, meaning you know, we're not seeing a ton of wage growth, except for what we are seeing this place in Austin. But then you'll also notice rent and home prices. Our home prices right now in the city of Austin, I think, so this goes from 2012 to 2023, and really just illustrates the growing gap between income and the cost of housing. Recognizing this in 2017, which is about halfway through that chart, we undertook as a city, I had just worked at the city, so I wasn't actually involved in this effort, creating what was known as the Strategic Housing Blueprint. It's a 10-year plan for housing. It was the first one in the city of Austin that ever completed. And it was really guided by some really foundational ideas. One is that we can't just produce housing. We just can't do that in a vacuum. We have to also preserve what we have. So you'll see the intersection of these two, which is both preserving and producing housing. All of our conversations with the community were guided by these five principles and values. And you'll see preventing households from being priced out of Austin is an incredible challenge. Kind of economy, fostering equitable communities, investing in housing for the most in need, creating new and affordable housing choices for Austinites all over Austin, and then helping Austinites reduce their housing costs. But this resulted in really looking at the need. And again, it was in 2017, so we're a solid 6 years in at this point. But we recognize that over 10 years of
community housing goals. So not just what the city was going to choose, but what we needed as a community was 135,000 housing units across the entire income spectrum. When you look at this, what we call donut chart, we, as a city, from a subsidy perspective, are focused on the 80% below median family income, which really is going to be the colored parts of the donut, green, the blue, and really a prime focus for us are the orange and the red. Those are really the hardest units to create. That's what we're sitting in right now, as we speak, in charters. So our focus, again, is 60,000 units over 10 years. That was the goal that was identified. That would mean producing 60,000 units a year for folks at a Well, how are we going to do that? Well, way back when, 6 years ago, in April of 2017, we got a plan. And it was ambitious and included bringing all of the community together to really tackle affordable housing challenges. And while you can't see it on this chart, I have to really zoom in. ACA and AAHC are one of those small slivers at the bottom. This is a stack that we created about really guiding us how we were going to get to that 60,000 deeply affordable units. And it was through a variety of strategies and tools. It was going to include federal funds, or general obligation loans. That would be the city's piece. Travis County Housing Authority is part of that density bonus program, which again is city-driven. The Housing Trust Fund, city-owned driven. And you'll see the small red slice, which is HACA and Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Our goal, I had to dig in and zoom in. The goal over 10 years was 1,384 units. So congratulations. You have far exceeded what anybody's expectations were back in 2017. So how are we doing as a community? We are challenged. So I just met with Vanessa. I think this was yesterday. It might have been the day before. Housing Works, and we were talking about our scorecard. When council adopted the blueprint, in 2017, we launched our tracking in 2018, and we do every year we do a look back in terms of how we're doing in advancing toward our goals related to affordable housing. We are about to release the 2022 scorecard. This is from 2021, and it shows progress to date between 2018 when we started counting and 2021. This probably won't be until October. We'll keep this in 2022, and it lags, so we'll look back about what we have produced. And it tells a mixed story, I'm not going to lie. Here you see every single city council district, how they're doing. This is 4 years in to the strategic housing blueprint. I have a splash because we'll be 5 years in this year when we release the report. And the story is somewhat similar. We have mixed results. We have some districts that are doing pretty well in terms of meeting their district goals. We have some areas that are doing very well. And one I will give a shout out for is aligning housing with transit. We have gone, I think our goal was that 75% of the units would be within a half mile of the Maginot Center or quarter, and we've gone above and beyond that area, which is fantastic. It's housing developments like this that have access to rich transportation system that we want to see more of. So we can help Austinites reduce their household costs, which includes transportation. Typically, it's the top three expenses for households, those housing transportation. When I look at this data, and again, mixed story, I try to take the silver lining. What I will say is we have a ton of units in the pipeline. So when we created these goals back in 2017 and started tracking them in 2018, we decided to track the units that were created. And one thing we didn't think about was that housing takes a long time. I don't know when y'all started planning for Chalmers, but my guess is it wasn't last year, right? It's the planning probably started taking place 10 years ago, at least. More. okay, So we have lots of examples where you start the planning and then you start pulling together the capital stack and then you get funding approved and then you start construction. And so the pipeline, I think, is something that I just really want to focus on.
Okay. So you know, the start data, we've been focusing a lot on districts. And I'm wondering, is there any way that you can correlate your districts and zip codes against the understanding?
So, Aves is the fancy PhD student who worked on that because we had to do a crosswalk because our zip codes don't perfectly match up. I mean, you can kind of match up, but we had to, because our direction was to do this by city council district, we had to kind of apportion accordingly. General obligation bonds. You all know we are, or I believe you know, we are currently in our fourth tranche of general obligation bonds. Voter approved debt for the city of Austin 2006, voters approved $55 million, 2013 was $65 million, 2018 was $250 million, and 2022, so almost a year ago, voters approved $350 million. You know that this goes into four different main investment areas, and that's rental housing development assistance, which is gap financing for affordable housing developers, ownership housing development assistance, same thing for ownership housing developers, GO repair, which is our home repair program, and then acquisition and development, and I heard Mike, you mentioned, you know, CAPA's acquisition program. AHFC has a similar program. To tap into dollars to purchase properties, typically they go on for future development. And I say that because in 2018 we were given authority to use $100 million to purchase land, and with that we purchased 62 acres of vacant land, three hotels for conversion to new permanent supportive housing. And we also purchased, these are somewhat, some of it is housing bonds, some of it is net dollars, two apartment complexes, small naturally occurring affordable housing complexes. One is 70 units, it's down on South Concourse, right by St. Ed's, and one is 40 units, it's on St. John's and Lamar, right at Crestview Station. So our goal is the preservation and creating the framework for construction.
So Mandy, are you aware whether any other city, I think some kind of made, but whether any other city does bonds for housing? I know Houston does not, and there's a big discussion going on in their community about trying to do something to get a kind of bond proposition dedicated for housing. And it's a big conversation we're struggling with. I don't think Dallas does, but I think
Dallas doesn't. And so you should know we're part of a multi-city, it's the big six cities, including El Paso. So Dallas, Houston, Fort Worth, San Antonio, El Paso, Houston. And this is one of the things that we convene around. Some of it is legislative issues, but also programmatic challenges. San Antonio is on their second official bond. The first one was kind of interesting because they had some charter issues that I can't quite remember the details, but they couldn't dedicate it until they cleaned up their charter issues to affordable housing development, so they tied it to infrastructure related to affordable housing, and it was a pretty small bond. This latest one is $200 million.
Something like that.
It's pretty significant.
It passed,
and they're in the process of rolling it out. But interestingly, San Antonio, different demographic, different market. I think about half of that is dedicated to home ownership in the sense of home repair. They have a significant number of code issues and code challenges, so they're kind of deploying their funds differently. But you are correct, lots of other cities are thinking of that as a funding source. But Houston and Dallas rely heavily on TIFs, tax increment finances.
And Dallas has one on the ballot this year. So they've been talking and learning from us. So I know you're the same talk to us as
sort of the Austin housing community over the years, and Dallas has one coming up just so.
Well, I just wanted to bring up, because I know people tend to bash Austin. I think that's nearer than you are the leader, because when I talk to people around the state in housing, that's the one thing they envy Austin about, is that, you know, you've got access to bond funding. I just saw San Antonio just passed their budget and have a small amount of money in the budget for housing, but it's a very small amount. It's for the housing. I think they're giving the housing for like $1 million.
Oh, wow.
And they just said, you know, it's great, but it's really,
it's not
really
enough.
Small.
It's not enough. Mm-hmm. And we're finding, so the $350 million that was just passed, it was appropriated by our city council in April. We actually pushed the first dollars out the door in June of this year. We have a 5-year spend plan. And again, we'll be deploying those dollars through these programs. The bulk of our money will most likely go to rental housing development assistance, because that's where we see the biggest need. And like it or not, with construction costs increasing, and you all know this better than anyone. I know you dealt with, probably dealing with Rosewood and various other projects. We're just seeing a bigger and bigger gap for our housing developers. And while we encourage them to find other sources of funding, like when they have certain funds, the FDLP, the state program, or other sources of funding like the Federal Home Loan Bank, but we know that we're a likely source of gap financing. So those are our general obligation funds. We have a quarterly funding cycle for both rental housing development and ownership housing development. And that's where we push out multiple sources of funding. So that includes our sources include Project Connect and their displacement dollars. General obligation bonds is our biggest source. But it also includes our federal funds. And it includes some of our food and move gather from density bonus programs. Here's a lot of numbers and some charts, and I'll give you the gist of it. This goes back 10 years, looking at the dollars that we have deployed each year for affordable housing. And one of the takeaways back in fiscal year 2011-2012, we didn't have as many sources of funds, and we couldn't invest in as many projects as we wanted to. Our investments have grown in terms of the dollar amounts over the years. Our sources have diversified. You'll see we have 2006, four of those are general obligation bonds. We also have housing trust funds, other local funding like BMLU, federal funding, and Project Connect. Our federal funding has been shrinking in terms of what we invest in affordable housing and our general obligation investments. I mentioned earlier about the pipeline. You'll see for both ROTA, rental housing on top, and the bottom, that really the pipeline is where we're going to see the bulk of our units produced. Here is information on the number of units that we've produced over that same financed, not produced. As I mentioned, you all know that there's a lag, right? So we finance something, and we are our board, Austin Housing Finance Corporation, approves the dollar amounts, and then we sign a contract, and then we start construction later, and then we start drawing down. So there definitely is a lag in terms of getting the units on the ground. We're trying to shorten that lag as best we can. But you'll see this is broken down by median family income. We're very proud of the number of deeply affordable units we've been able to incentivize through our gap financing. And again, our focus is on 30, 40, 50% units. There are also 60% units. Almost all of the developments we come with are mixed income developments, but our investment goes. Our investment goes to the deeply affordable units. And you'll see in the last couple of years, this is the current year, a little over 1,000 units were financed in affordable housing.
So, I would say next year, in this report, the work that we're doing at Rosen Courts will probably stand out as significant for the lowest income levels.
So what we'll see is Rosewood Courts was approved this fiscal year. It was the last fiscal year. It was approved, but we're not going to see it.
Oh, it needs to be.
it's going to be probably two more fiscal years, right?
Hopefully it'll be Chalmers West.
We'll see Chalmers, and that'll come up. And this all goes into our affordable housing inventory, where we invest in any affordable housing units. We have a list of all of our housing and that includes anything that we've subsidized, but it also includes anything that we've incentivized, like debt city funded programs, which have produced a fairly significant amount of units, not deeply affordable, but typically at 60% or 80% median family income. Still matters, part of the spectrum of who we need to serve, but our subsidy dollars are going to target a lower income. This also, all of the data feeds into, thank you all for being a partner in a project that we're hoping to enhance. We created 3 years ago, I was, but the AVOS, the Affordable Housing Online Search Tool. And that is a web-based platform that will enable low-income people to access affordable housing throughout the city of Austin, and with anything we've subsidized, y'all have subsidized housing authority of Travis County or any typical LIHTC local housing county. We are getting ready to submit a grant application for, if all goes well, by October 30th to HUD for $10 million over 5 years, and to do a variety of things. One is to update the strategic housing blueprint, because we're now 6 years in just goals and do more community-based understanding of needs across the city that change nationally. And also we need to update our strategies in terms of reaching those affordable housing goals. Another thing we're proposing to do is really jazz up our AHOS, the online search tool, our vision, which other communities have done, is real-time data, so that right now it's pretty static, but we'd like low-income people who are often in crisis. They may be being evicted. They may be to be able to pull up options to be able to apply online, know that there is a vacancy, know what the tenant screening criteria is, and if there are, in fact, criminal background checks that preclude somebody from, we don't want people to have to run through a bunch of hoops if the housing is not an option for them. So other communities have done this, and we know that it's possible.
I've got two quick questions. Yeah. One, going back to this form that provides all the data on the website, is that pursuant to the building's past succession? There was electrical as a building at past legislative session required, it was actually a requirement that cities have to post all this information on their website, so that if you were looking for housing, whether it's tax credits, et cetera, you can go to a website and find it. I think it was
House Bill. Oh, my goodness. I don't know if you can tell me what House Bill it is. I think it would comply with that. It is available on our website. That was not why we created it. It really was a community-based need we heard over and over again back in the day. Some of you may remember the Austin Tenants Council used to produce an guide to affordable housing, and it was papers that you would have to go find, and then you would look through the papers and see what was available. And so we took that, and we've taken it a step up, but there's certainly a lot more work that needs to happen, so that would be perfect. It is available on our website, though, and I certainly hope you're in compliance with this House bill that I didn't know about.
Yeah, I think it's 5525.
5525?
Thank you. I can tell you the actual problem.
And I can figure, I'll figure it out if you can tell me that.
Representative Flores out of San Antonio.
At 5.
I think that's the real number, but the reason why I know about it is I got called on it and I kind of turned it down, work on the project, I had a full plate, but I kind of followed it because I thought it was interesting.
Okay.
I wonder if PBHCA was required to pull that together. It sounds like
So TXCA, you may recall, has the vacancy, clearing, which is, it's all the LIHTC projects across the state, and it does, I think it's updated quarterly, and it does say that they may have one bit. Again, it's useful, but it's not as useful.
The second thing, going back to mixed use, then a question given that in terms of mixed use on the commercial side, it's my understanding, and that's why I have some support in mind as I come to the briefing, and on the commercial side, the city's over there. And so if you're going to build mixed use and there's already vacant space, is that the best use of the dollar?
So, I can only speak to, I was just part of a presentation with our friends, Comfort Capital Market, JLO, and UPS, looking specifically at downtown. And for downtown in particular, the leasing has withstood. Now, that doesn't mean that people are in the space, but they have, the space is leased and somebody is paying the lease. Retail is pretty strong downtown, which was surprising. And commercial space was suffered during the pandemic, but didn't go down as a comparison with different major cities. I have heard from our friends who are new developers and one of them excuse me, requires that you have that ground floor retail, that they don't even, when they go to underwrite the projects, they don't count anything on the ground floor because they're assuming it's going to be pretty significant. You know, a lot of and they're counting on the rents, you know, the stories two and above. We have very few projects, like LIHTC projects, that incorporate commercial spaces. It's not uncommon, but typically they're condominiumized and they're financed separately. So I cannot, I'm thinking Aldridge 50 in Miller, Mueller, Aldridge 51 in Wildflower, then we have commercial spaces. We're about to break ground in the Seabrook Square, which is really exciting. On the road just south of Miller, Mueller, it will have commercial space and good workspace focused on commercial. Coffee shop going in, but that has all been lined up in ahead of the financing for any of the shows. I don't know if that answered the question.
I was just concerned about the whole deal because that's what I've been hearing. It's on the commercial side, there's open space, a lot of vacant space, and so I was just wondering.
I see a lot of vacant space. I think all of that, I think a number of different things. I think one, if y'all were right, there's a lot of older buildings serving geographies, but not in front of them. So I think in some parts of town, like Manistee, like BMU is, North Carolina, we see a lot of that kind of a commercial space and it's vacant. Doesn't necessarily mean it will happen in other places as well. And you manage one, we have good examples of Wildflower Terrace, which is there with commercial at the bottom, the Chigong here by the Chestnut by Division 40 has commercial good examples. And I will say there's a big demand from the community. On the Planning Commission, this is something we hear often. Folks really want walkable commercial around them. So as we're building new developments, a lot of existing neighborhoods are like, yes, the housing is great and we want new neighbors and we want different kinds of neighbors, but we also want some walkable commercial that serves us. So there's an interesting conversation between serving those communities as well.
Focus on local based
business. Yes,
local based business. I'm hearing a lot about.
Why would that maybe grab a little more of the bunch?
Oh, I'm
just
saying. I'm getting it over to a mess and I'm
heading out. I thought it passed. It actually didn't get the final vote we needed, but it was HB 5255 by Ray Lopez.
Great.
And it may be worth reading.
Okay, good. 5255?
Yeah, 5255 by Ray, House Bill 5255 by Ray Lopez. And it basically, the language basically mimics what you all have already done.
Great. that we'd like to be a model.
But yeah, the person I find that used to work for she and her husband drafted the legislation, pushing that they reached out to me.
I'll check that.
Well, sure. Thank you so much. Well, and stay for as long as you can.
Oh, no, I'm staying.
Let's turn over to this.
Appreciate it. So again, I'll there'll be a little bit of repetition. Hopefully, folks can bear with me. Again, I serve on that diversity committee of House and Work, so I really wanted to bring in some of the work that we've done actually with Mike and Ben and both for 8-9 years now. So from a House and Work perspective, I feel like this really encapsulates what we're talking about. Really, we believe in this model of all kinds of homes in all parts of town for all kinds of people. And our mission as an organization really sort of tracks that. And I'll talk a little bit about what does that mean. So for us, really, this turns into some guiding principles for our advocacy. The first one, you'll see a lot of it overlapping with what the city's thinking about, expanding affordable housing opportunities, particularly for those most in need. So really focusing on really the lowest income housing units or supporting family-based housing or seniors. So really looking at who is most in need in our community. Serving those folks. Really expanding the housing choice to residents, so really having different kinds of household compositions, living situations, whether folks want town homes, whether they want to live in a multi-unit complex, whether they want to live in something close to transit. There's a lot of different situations, and particularly honestly with a lot of multi-generational households that we're going to see, and a lot of complex combined households. This is kind of a big aspect of the market. Currently, creating and also preserving housing in high opportunity areas, really to further our fair housing commitments, having more housing dispersion. We know that there are certain areas considered high opportunity where folks have better access to jobs, education, and other kinds of amenities to the need for a open life. And we'll see a little bit of that in the map form as well. Really employing active displacement and right to return strategies. So really, how do we ensure that folks can stay in their communities and those who have been forced out, how do we bring them back in is an important aspect. And then lastly is how do we just have better quality of life for residents and the creation of complete communities that serve all needs of the household. Many kind of touched on this, access to transit, access to educational opportunities, food access, and so on.
Yeah, so on that last one, you know, we got on the ballot coming up in November. This proposition related to broadband. And the question got posed to me by a colleague of mine. I had her reach out to Captain Craig, and it is, what is the affordable housing community doing to get to make sure some of that money gets used for affordable housing? So you got $5 million for broadband, so just put it everywhere in the state. And there are a lot of all my friends in Dallas, if you know, you can go to South Dallas, which is in the central city, and you really don't have Wi-Fi. And so the question is, you know, what are we doing in terms of enhancing the quality of life? Because, you know, those of us who sit around here are all educated, got money and everything, and we've got living in some of that Wi-Fi.
I want to say on scene, Hawkeye is a perfect example of the great work that y'all done in your partnership with Google Fiber, creating those tech and computer spaces in each property. I feel like there's a lot to learn from the way Hawkeye has done it and expanded digital access. And I agree with you. I think we're realizing more and more that digital access has to be seen as digital infrastructure. We definitely saw this during COVID, where we were asking children to take their schoolwork home and work if you did not have access to good Wi-Fi. Was it being determined to your brain's working or you get school? So agreed with that, that we have to look into formal housing and see it truly as an infrastructure.
I was thinking about is Wi-Fi now is like air conditioning. It's not a necessity. I mean, it's not a luxury. It's a necessity. If you're going to be able to function in our society, yeah, because it's in the way we communicate with the phones, you know, computers, whatever, and with groceries, you telemedicine, seniors, So I see it as more, it's a necessity of not a luxury.
So there's, here, yes. We just completed a survey that took like a month to complete on our overall engagement with those dollars. I think they're going to be largely distributed by the FCC, according to the top 40 with the FCC. So we're definitely in the middle of that stage. We want to make sure that people of color, people of the story they deserve, and people of the pockets that are underserved folks. That we are one. And so we're one 300 states that have submitted responses. So we feel very confident. Spent a lot of time thinking about those answers. Do you want to make sure that people are reported in my behind, like our presidents? Don't miss them. Just do it. We have a lot on the table. Go ahead.
Just Hawkeye is at the forefront of this. I will say that we, from our subsidy perspective, we looked at scoring different applications, and broadband is a priority, but we talked about should it be a local requirement. We're not giving you any subsidy money unless you demonstrate that you have the broadband.
So really, the next piece I want to focus on was this chart that we had housing refugees called, who needs housing that's affordable, just to contextualize. We talked a lot about these MFIs, and sometimes it's not very clear who we're talking. So we sort of have these four categories. There's households that are living below poverty. That's essentially, at this point, for those who are earning less than $27,500. And there's 44,000 households that fall within that category. And then we have these three other categories of those who are at below 50% in MFI. There's 141,000 households there that are eligible for bond-funded projects. There's 50 to 80% MFI. So that's 55,000 to 88,000 roughly. And that's nearly 80,000 households there. And a reminder that increasingly we're seeing it's becoming very hard for that category to actually find housing. Certainly non-home ownership, that has to be affordable. And then as we look at moderate income, really we're looking at folks up to 120,000. But really at that level too, ownership is increasingly becoming a big challenge. I again do not need to tell you all, as Mike was mentioning, just we've had really difficult times in recent years because of the COVID pandemic. We of course had a once in a lifetime health crisis, but associated with that was an economic crisis. Inflation rates have gone up, materials have become more expensive and more difficult to access. Labor has become much harder to access. All the labor trends are now trending in the right direction. But because of all of that, just the core unit cost has gone substantially up than it used to be.
How does this compare to what we experienced in 2008, 2009 when we had the great economic displacement?
We don't have data from back there, but that's a good question. What we have seen, I will say, so we started tracking this data at housing works in 2014, 2015.
Okay.
And I hate to say, not those professions that are mentioned in there, they've slid down. Like, I'll be honest,
yeah.
When we started this, elementary school teachers were low income, but high school teachers were not. Now high school teachers fall within the low income category. Same goes for RNs. So really, as Matt mentioned, wages have been flat enough that even post-recession, the 2008 recession, we've seen people slowly shift into lower and lower income categories because their wages are not good.
No, totally agree. And one thing we're seeing, that chart I had about wages or the median family income, it really dips up the last couple of years. We have seen increases in median family income in the city of Boston. 11% in 1 year and 12% in 1 year. And what we have found is that it's not that we all started making more money. It's that people moved in, we were making more money. There were more high-wage jobs, and people were moving out who were lower income. So kind of the gap is growing a little bit, and the demographics are shifting in a way that we're trying to get our arms around.
And just one kind of thing that I'll add to that is, if you look at really the lowest end, think folks on fixed incomes like Social Security, really that has not increased at all. I hate to say, when you think about those folks, it's almost disheartening to understand how those households manage, because they simply don't have enough money to even be able to make pay for food, particularly with rising costs and inflation.
Just for a fine point, that we work with an awful lot of folks that come in, and the only income they have is Social Security, and I check, $1,300 a month. That's just to buy just a regular apartment in Austin.
Exactly.
That's impossible.
I mean, rent, you get 17. So, I mean, let alone that, even if we gave those folks completely free healthcare and completely free housing, frankly, with the way food prices have gone up, inflation, other things, just regular needs have gone above that 30,000 annual. Really horrifying way to see that. Not to go into too much detail, but this is, so as part of our work at HouseWorks, we do this thing called district analysis. So we look at metrics more broadly. So we look at, for example, subsidized housing stock. This includes both things that the city has sort of enabled and touched and funded, but also beyond that. And by our assessment, we have essentially around 51,000 affordable units in the city of Austin as a whole. This includes things that are from Grass County, the Housing Authority, City of Boston, low-income housing tax credit that does not include city funding, and so on. So there's a number of different things. And there's roughly 28,500 units that are existing in these buildings can be occupied by residents, with, as Manny mentioned, really that 22,400 in the pipeline. So we know that our pipeline has expanded substantially in recent years, which is exciting, but again, that pipeline really slowed down. So it was already running to almost 3 years for subsidized housing project. And with the COVID pandemic, it went to 5-ish years. So that pipeline has really slowed down. Hopefully we'll make up for it as we go along. Again, just looking at some metrics, the cost of living, the average rent per month in Austin is hovering around $1,700. And the median home price is around $590,000. We've seen some decrease in our median home price locally, but again, nowhere near sort of where we know what the need is. The same with for folks experiencing homelessness. It's been good that we've really kept our numbers stable. Our population hasn't grown a lot like other communities, but still we have over 1,200 people who are in unsheltered homelessness. So the way I would describe it is these are folks living on the streets. These are not people who have access to other kinds of services. And same with poverty rate. You can see that beyond the households that we just looked at, it's 116,000 folks living below poverty in the city of Austin. So
big count was higher.
Big count. So we are also by this data from last year. So this
That's
year,
right.
we're
okay.
thinking the number goes up.
And big count includes unsheltered.
And shelter.
Okay.
So that's the big number will always be like around 3,000, but that includes people who have been in shelters, people who are in transitional housing. This is really focused on the street who have almost no access to any housing. So we focus on this number because of this, how crucial it is.
So let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Because there was a building I filed, and it will be refiled. And this would require you to try to find a way to also improve count servers at your accounts. So in terms of services, that would basically really hurt you, right?
The
couch surfing is a tough one. Or doubling, tripling up. I think it's very common. I don't know how we count that. I've done the big count multiple times. It's hard to even find people. You're at encampments. A lot of people live in their cars. You can't find them or count them. But now that I think of it, for school districts, they do have
So that's what the deal is. The way you count from the HUD definition to the Department of Education's definition.
Exactly. And so the HUD definition by which we get our federal dollars, we only found folks who are not couch surfing, for example. But to Manny's point, under the McKinney-Vento Act, our education, AISD, counts those folks. And when you count that, the number is much, much larger. And to your point, although we're looking at this number because it's a HUD requirement, and that's what the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness tells us we need to count, the service need is much larger. So we know that folks who are couch surfing need services. That's an important point. I won't cover too much over cost work, but this is something Raul mentioned as well. But currently in the city of Boston, 35% of our households are cost burden, i.e. they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing, with 16% being extremely cost burden, which means more than 50% of the income is spent on housing. So if you think for a second, if there's 16% households that are spending more than half of the income on housing, it leaves very little behind for healthcare, childcare,
transportation and other costs, which adds to the challenge. I'll try to go through the rest of it. Maggie already mentioned this. I'm not going to go with this, but I do want to look at this chart. So this looks at against our goals that the community established with our strategic housing blueprint, how close are we to those goals? So I would focus on those bar charts on the left side. And I can share these slides afterwards if folks want to look. I know this is a lot of data, so I can share that. But if you look at this, you see how close we are to our goals. I would look at those blue bars, the three at the bottom, because those are at 30% median family income, lower 30-60%, and then 60-80%. And what we're seeing is, particularly for the affordable housing categories, including going up to 80% of five, which is past the local housing basket or our local dollars, there's a big need. So even when we look at that 61-80%, we have not created the amount of affordable units that would be needed at those levels to serve those. So not to deliver it too much, but if you look at the bar charts on the right, let's look at that little red bar in the middle for 80% of five. And you can see that those folks who are up to 80% of five can only afford 22% of housing in our market. So that's a real challenge, even though that's a significant amount of people in our
community.
Yes.
Also, so it's just for purposes of this board, because the question that really comes up is, you know, are we overbuilding? I think that we're almost exclusively building, you know, at 100% below, you know, our PSE yields at 50% at 80. But, you know, we're really tapping into particularly this market here. We get as many of these as we can, and sometimes there's some of these as well. But we've had an awful lot that we can still contribute to commercial. Yeah, so I hope the board feels very confident that the difference we're making at the level that, you know, really, you know, critical need for the city, but where at this point, you know, I don't think we're at any risk of saturation, but it's still worth coming back to and make sure, you know, testing assumptions.
That's right. And I would honestly need hundreds of podcasts. As you can see, that gray bar is what we know what we need in the community years. The blue is what we have built in the past 5 years. To my point, really, the need is so much greater. And frankly, any help that HACA or AC or others can provide, it's very much.
It is the lower income where we are most challenged, and that chart really demonstrates that.
Yes.
And when I said that during my slides, there was a 16,000 small slices that we on above and beyond, but we're filling a need that is so large. We as a city thought we could produce more than we thought we could produce as well, which is fantastic. But it really encompassed all of us to figure out the way to create those.
But it is a little bit early to say.
Yeah, no, but that's part of your email address.
100 units. And I'm not sure how many of those bars you have.
It's caused by the people that you did have your address.
You meant to find, right? We're doing really well in terms of metrics of what you would realistically accomplish, and, you know, partners, but also the city. But if you look at the needs, the sheer needs that we have for folks in different countries, there's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So you heard him say that
as his world and I had the same.
Well, they ended everything.
When I sign up for something, I usually just never check it.
Thing that I really appreciate is when
I give an email address.
I'm an AHS, so it's super confusing. But when we are producing this, even at that, you know, 60 or 80%, and you're accepting housing from Scott Jones, it's a game changer.
So
great. Yeah.
It sucks.
I won't spend too much time on this, but we're doing really well on the corridors, like Maddie mentioned. We're not doing as well as a city on expanding housing to high opportunity. So you'll see we had a goal of 25% affordable housing. We've only been able to achieve 18%. So we really do need to expand to newer areas that are high opportunity. And we'll look at some of that. I won't again talk a bit too much about our affordable housing bonds. We're on our fourth bond, which is very exciting. To the chair's point,
it's, we are truly leading the state in that way. And it's been very exciting talking to other communities who are learning from us and trying to come up on it. All that said, if you look at the way the units are sort of distributed, you don't need to look at anything detailed, but just to know that within this, the green dots are 2006 bonds, the blue ones are 2032 bonds, and then the orange, yellow are 2018 bonds. And you can see really the 2006 bonds were almost all in the central east part. We realized that we needed to expand into other parts of our cities, expand opportunities. You see the blue dots in the next round, go a little more south. And then really we've been trying to go more north and northwest, west in general, with the latest bonds. And actually the work of AHC, like Bentry Apartments and others, is really critical there to expanding opportunities, pretty preservation and high opportunity. Just two nine things and I'll end here.
And Bentry, I would make note, it's mentioned in Matt Desmond's book on poverty. It's one of the books, things that is part of contributing to the success of the Affordable Housing Forum.
I did not know that.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
How's that, you know, this perception of affordable housing? So if you want to change the perception, you go to some property somewhere else and they said, or go to Bentry Apartments, which is the rent program, the eviction prevention program we do with the city as well, comes in that book as well. It's,
I did know that.
Successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, right to that point, it's exciting to talk to other parts of the state to realize in Austin, we feel like we're not doing enough. We talk to people in other parts of the state and we realize we're doing more than most other departments. Last thing was, I think, just that last piece of how we also have more conversation around that selection and quality of life, lowering barriers to accessing housing. And I think Hawkins really led the charge on this and done a great job with the work that y'all did last year. And working on those, you know, necessary on-site and off-site support services, particularly for firms, supportive housing. Again, you have the health care clinic at Chalmers, you were talking about iDads and iMoms, just the sheer volume of programs provided by Hoffman again is really important for supporting residents beyond simply just having an affordable unit, having a good quality of life. Again, and I know this part of the requirements, but Hoffman would lead the charge again on having tenant organizations and part of tenant associations and being able to work with them. And lastly, just having other rights protected and having provision of quality of life. So this is something we're trying to do more and more with the bond dollars to make sure that the kind of work that's happening here spreads out more. We make sure that we're lowering barriers to accessing housing and having better quality of life. The last thing I'll say is this is back in management. We created this in 2014. Five steps to keeping Austin affordable. And things we talked about at the time, really those first, you know, four are really critical, where the way I see Haka and HC helping us. Preserving housing, so similar to Benjamin and others, including the ones off of Riverside, how we sort of preserve them, and HC has done a really good charge of leading with that, including Haka itself with the way the properties have been maintained in public housing. Investing in new housing and expanding it, John, this is a perfect example, expansion of those affordable housing, leveraging our scarce dollars. So we're very proud of the fact that our affordable housing bonds, we have a 6.5 leverage ratio. So for every $1 in public dollars for our bonds, we're spending $6.5 from other means for affordable housing. So that's very exciting. And lastly, the fourth, the partner part is really important. The city cannot do this work by itself, nor can one housing provider or another. So really, it is Haka, AC, and others that we need to help. And as you all saw, the need is much higher. If you have that good access to affordable housing in good areas with good quality of life, it's really critical that we have all of your help. So thank you all for your attention.
So can you go back to the very first slide?
First one?
Right there.
Oh,
so, you know, your tagline, all kinds of homes in all parts of town, all kinds of people. You know, I think that's brilliant. And I think it's a good message to sell at the Capitol. One thing I would encourage you to do, because Representative Armando Lally a couple of weeks ago convened a Zoom call with a number of housers from around the state. To get ideas. And one of the things I talked about and challenged other folks on the call is to think about finding a way to enhance and make the housing trust fund more with us, because it is so narrow. And when I was now a presidential around the country, Montana has a very robust housing trust fund. I'm in a state with a very sparse population, a very red state. And they got a housing trust fund. And they were giving out money to various affordable housing organizations to build affordable housing in Montana. And when I was there, I didn't really think about Montana being the one that has a lot of need. It does, because you've got so many people from California who move it in, displacing the folks who are there because they're moving in, buying, you know, large tracts of land. Prices are just going up, you know, sky high for them. So they created a housing trust fund, and we have one. I don't really consider the housing trust fund. It's so narrow. It's so limited. But that would be one thing I think you would want to give the big six to talk about. Okay. How can we, you know, talk about it and find a way to make a very robust housing, state housing trust fund? Because again, Austin's the only one, maybe Dallas, that is doing it. I mean, we know bond funding, you know, the state issued all sorts of bonds. You know, that would be an ideal thing, because the state really doesn't invest in housing, and it should.
I could not agree more.
So I would just encourage you. I would encourage you to get with the big six, talk about it, and take it, you know, for the state to figure it out. Because again, if the state contributes, the local government's contributing with the money to the federal government, you just grow the pot and it's easier.
Right.
And so that would be a way, that would be something I would encourage you all to do.
Right. Sure.
Thank you. Any other questions?
So most of the things on the page probably just if I wanted to know what the city was doing, and I've said it on, and I've been on the board for 20 years, but if I hadn't, the people, you might as well have been talking to someone's script. So much of it is acronyms and numbers and pie charts, and I don't worry about that.
What can we do to?
Well, I would say for somebody like me, just a two pages bullet points. Here's what we need to do, and here's what we're going to do. I don't need all the long stuff to finish up and how we do it. We need, at the end, I think I mentioned, we need, based on our studies and projections, this amount of affordable housing. This is what we've got to have. And here's my ideas to get there. And I know that's what you've been saying.
And we can condense it down.
We can do that.
Absolutely.
But I think from the city's perspective, I mean, the last person of elected officials is, yeah, there's three big themes, you know, three big takeaways, and this is the data. Back it up. Keep doing what you're doing. Get more of it. And frankly, you know, figure out other creative ways to bring different types of housing products on board, because of lots of unique needs and special populations that we need to serve. We've got seniors, disabilities, families with kids, and others. But, you know, partner with folks who provide the services that create community. But all across the big world is more, just do more. And I think that's the charge to the Travis County has an authority as well. Either that from elected official at the county level.
But I need more to do what we've been doing, do a better job than what we've been doing. We all know that we're pushing the envelope probably way beyond where we should be. Anyway, I appreciate y'all coming in, and I can tell you know what you're talking about, but I don't.
Any other questions?
Well, I appreciate looking at the data, and I guess I'm sort of a data person, but I did learn quite a bit today, and I'm sort of writing down some figures. I mean, we had one of which was that Austin population, 50% of renters and 50% of homeowners. I would not have known that. And those are the kind of figures that grab and sort of say, If we, and we know, and I looked at that other chart where you're looking at where the building is taking place and it's all high. Well, we knew that every single condo that goes up is unaffordable for people who work in the city. And we don't have an infrastructure for people who live outside the city to get back to work. And that issue is critical. So, keep it up.
Let me ask you one last question. How do it is striking me in terms of the proportion between rent and home ownership? How does it compare to the all different first homeowners?
Very similar, actually.
I was going to say renters went down.
Renters went down. So we used to be at 54%
yes.
renters. Okay. So we were more renters and we've gone down to 50, but we're hovered within that percentage.
Yeah.
It's sort of gone from 54, 51, 50. Regardless, Austin has sort of been majority vendors for the years that we've been tracking the let's say a decade. We're heavy on the vendors. And one thing I'll add to what you were saying, I think it's very critical, not to sort of take too much time, but it really became important to us during the pandemic. We became very clear. We talk about these critical workers, but those critical workers cannot live in our city. Good example of that was the Doctor and Nurses Union, who are now increasingly fighting for affordable housing. They were talking about the fact how nurses were taking 24 on shifts because they're like, well, I have to come from Maynard. It's
right.
easier for me to do a longer shift and then take a day off and stay at home
right.
rather than coming back and forth, even though they felt like that was not the best for their physical health. And so we're putting people in difficult decisions by not having affordable housing in the center wards. So
I read something not long ago that I like about the life of policemen or firemen and for churches. Make the affordable housing part of their income. I thought what
compensation
overall compensation. And to me, then you got really what you created. So the solutions you can say what we like to do is thank you fix money and we're good to have the same type stops here. Same environment, same teachers.
We are having lots of conversations. The panel I just came from it was talking about AISD. So Austin Independent School District, they have not similar to other organizations, enormous challenges around affordable housing. Teachers is one thing, but you think about bus drivers, custodians, and kitchen staff. And I was with somebody, a demographer at AISD. It was fascinating. They pinpointed where everybody lives, you know, all of their employees. And the bus drivers are way, they're the farthest ones away. The custodians, the kitchen, the lower paid you are, the farther out you are, and then teachers can gradually get a little bit closer, but still they're challenged as well. So AISD is looking at creative solutions. Housing Works has an employer-assisted housing program. They've been working with AISD, and it gets to that point about, can that become part of your, can that be something that your employer offers? Because we all benefit. I mean, we all benefit when our people who are serving us, frankly, whether it's, you know, serving in the cafeteria or serving us for healthcare or whatever, when they live closer to their jobs. So it's something that I think, I'm not going to say we're going to be on the forefront because I know a lot of Chicago has done an enormous amount of work around employers who have some assets for them. I think it's something that we're going to start to see some progress on.
Well, and maybe the legislature with our large pile at the
One can help.
So I guess one last question. Just kind of point. You know, going back to the Housing Trust Fund, if you were able to tap into law enforcement, observers, and the lobby, you know, versus and first responders that may view your group, they can talk about it, that the legislature may be receptive to, which goes to my next point, is, you know, you teach a surveillance, you're going to do the deal with energy. Where are those folks going to live?
That's why I'm headed down to city council, actually. I'm going to talk about a property that the city owns, not that far from there. My desire is that we could have something because we are looking at an enormous influx of healthcare workers, but we also downtown enormous number of service industry workers, and those are folks at the 50% below median family income. Now, healthcare workers, obviously, have at all the data that go up to 80% and above kind of mixed income product that would enable people to live downtown, to me, is a great American.
I'll end by just saying, I think that foreign piece here, we've been talking about it for a decade or more, is partnering. We need our employers on board. We need our other public agencies on board. We need our housing authorities and HCs. There's nothing, none of this work in anybody's want at all. We're going to need you all partners. So, we're trying to talk to you, Deathline Oracle as well. So in the bar system housing, we're having those conversations. And I think increasingly they're beginning to see that they have a big issue with recruiting employees and retaining employees. Now, of course, the challenge there, again, is there's very high end of employees who are doing really well, but then every facility that you have, there's custodial staff, there's administrative staff, and those folks are starting to be very hard to mention that.
The city's on a great job purchasing strategic parcel of our city and the commercial. One of which we're actually partnering with. So,
they don't slide. It's not the chairs, it's the painted floor.
Project. There are other questions that are very, very challenging. And so, it's a good time to achieve those objectives. And overlay them to before we get the totally away, I have a privilege to serve for the board's information. You know, one of the things that has been so helpful about the data is that I think you all see the value of really good data. We can make it clearer and more usable, user friendly, but having institutions in the city that provide great data is really key. And how it works is that many help to this county executive director and provides a huge wealth of data. That's been on board for years and years. It's been awful on that research. We do conferences. I have a company to share. We've made an organizational commitment to housing boards to deliver this thing that no one else in the city got. And provides data that holsters these conversations. Stay strong. So we have a deal with this person and since that partnership has long had to continue to deliver to tell us what we should be building, what we shouldn't be building, the kinds of investments that we make, help guide good decision making. And they can understand.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So turning to the status of the deal. Why don't we turn very quickly to Austin PSC agenda? All that agenda.
Thank you.
Before we do that, can you come get Suzanne? Because part of what I wanted to get out of this also is the labor numbers have come out prepared for me. You're looking at this. How would that impact what we're doing for this? So what number cases in terms of the viability of
as of today, construction market, this is dead. Okay. This is dead now. And we already know we're going to get more rate increase by the end of this year. Rates is now 7%. To do any of that, cost of capital is extremely expensive. And when people, all talk about the affordable side and the social side and all this, but it really makes this work because people are bringing us money to help build it. They are not bringing money. There's too much risk. We've seen infections go down versus go up. Cost of capital is extremely difficult to bring money into this market right now. And everyone is struggling with that. Values are still too high to do acquisition. Think about last year or the year before, I brought you 13 deals in 1 year. We've done two. We may not see any more of the rest of this year. There's nothing on the market. And if it is, it's not viable. What's weird, just so you know, in the reverse is that this stoppage in construction and this no rebuilding, 2 years from now, there's going to be this massive gap. We're already underserving, and now we're not, now we're not building. And so it's going to catch up to us. When that comes, I'm not sure, but I would say probably 2 to 3 years. So projects that are coming online, they're starting to get developed now, that would be in construction of 2025, maybe is what we're looking at, 2 years. It'll be timing to be pretty darn good at that point. But right now, there's absolutely nothing that can possibly, and it's very, very difficult. But I will say, the rental market has come down, and actually it's less than 1,700. It's about 1,662 right now, last quarter. And what you're seeing is the opportunity for more people in the affordable world to move around and get into it. Before, we couldn't do that. So it's taking its toll because of so many units that were built. We've got to absorb, we have to absorb 40-something thousand units that are on the ground. You're seeing your occupancies. Well, we were 96, 98, as a city. Now we're 93. We watched a video, a presentation from CoStar this week. Fourth quarter, they're projecting another 3% drop in occupancy, fall down to 90, 91 to 90, 89, depending on certain submarkets. So everybody sees that. Players see that. And so they're all staying inside. So this big just stoppage. So what you're doing in the rental market is you're just trying to keep your tenants happy. You're doing the best you can. You're trying to keep a lot of stability. You're not seeing rent increases. You're trying to do things that keep them from moving out and going in places. Rents that were at 120% of AMI are now at 80% of AMI, and we're serving 80% of the AMI. So now you're seeing this, it's a moment in time where there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for even the affordable people. It's still expensive, don't get me wrong. It's still high. Our AMIs are high. But we've seen a drastic come back. And we've seen this before. We've sat through this cut several markets way back when we were here in 2008. And we had the problem with dealing with a few properties at the time. But I think it really is the cost of capital that's hurting. No one, the credit price is down. The investment market is really, they got money. They're just not putting it in here right now because there's easier returns elsewhere with that less risk. That's what we're seeing right now.
And we're seeing management companies have to, where they were sitting back going, everybody's coming to us. They're really having to market and do their job a lot harder to get.
And the last thing I'll say is when you talk about the average price of rent, what I don't know if they're calculating is owners are still trying to keep their rents up as best they can. So they're saying it's $1,700 a month, which is the average, but they're giving you a 2 month concession. They give it to you on the front end, so you get 2 months free rent. So then month three, you're paying $1,700. So then they can show that we're getting $1,700 a month. Really, if you factor in 2 months of free rent and multiply it out and replace the term, it's way down. So the concessions are being, there's concessions, especially on the new deals that are just trying to lease up and just are dying on the line. We've seen capital pool in the middle of construction. I was telling Carrington, the property 15 South Lamar, it's a few foot right there on Old Torch.
they just pulled their capital out halfway through. It's fine. We invested anymore. We're sitting there going, what do we do? And you're starting to see those types of things. People pay at the peak in 2020 when they're paying ridiculous amounts of dollars with short-term interest rate money, and now they're kicked in. You're starting to see those deals crumble. So it's a very, 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 there are still deals out there, don't get me wrong, but they're very, it's just very tough right now. So I haven't seen this since, I go back to 2008, maybe we're going to go down to somewhere like 2012 or 13. But anyway, this was a tough one.
Yeah, and part of the influx of units that's a problem is through COVID, we got delayed six months to a year. Now all of those that we thought were going to come online last year are coming this year with the ones that started. So I think the market just needs to absorb them, and then it's going to get back.
It's going to get worse before it gets better. Yeah. Overall, we're doing pretty well in our software. You can see your occupancy rates on your maps. We're generally in the mid to upper 90s. We have a few. One property had 90 leases expire that it was a corporate lease down on the riverside. And so that's the Henley. That's coming back stronger now, but it's in the 80s. But yes. It is.
It's not any projects that we implemented in the last year's responsibility to hire people that were part.
No, they can't. They're too invested. What they are doing is they're being more involved in the. In the next 3 weeks, I have everybody come in on the asset management side to sit down and start redoing budgets for next year, redoing projections, looking at where we can save. And, you know, where can we value add things? So you're seeing their asset management team more proactive in how we're managing, you know, how we're setting rents. I mean, you've got to remember, a lot of these people were doing 12 to 20% rent bumps a year on their budgets. We're performing maybe three, looking at 3 to 3.5 for 2024. So we're taking a very conservative approach to it. But no, they're in it for the long haul. They're just not going to hit their numbers. They may not hit the numbers as much as they thought. But again, we're not hurting them terribly. We're doing fine. But I just think overall the city is a big, there's a big lull right now in the multifamily market. Retail is killing it. Retail is still very strong.
But our ability to do more is going to be more challenging.
So we're just being extremely cautious.
Extremely cautious.
It's always been a conservative.
Always.
And
I've never been aggressive, in my opinion.
We hope to see, again, we've looked at deal after deal after deal after deal. Where you get that, but we're having it's a tough go right now. I mean, in terms of new building, new acquisition, new capital, you know, people know it's coming back. I think you're going to see an influx of new deals start putting together in 2024 on the construction side. You know, and lining up for 25 and 26 for your peers to break ground and start leasing. So I think we'll see that. It kind of worries me about the next 5 years.
So in the spirit of in terms of measure to the
spirit of moving forward.
Yes, sir. What are we going to the
I thought you had already taken care of all of that.
Not yet.
Okay. Yes, we can.
Item 1 is the consent agenda, which is approving the board minutes for June 15th.
Second.
Seconded by Alice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. I have a suggestion for program check. So these five items are actually simply a request to go and submit an application. In the old days, you didn't have to submit an application. But there was a submits in the lottery. But now you've seen this before. We have no idea that any get an allocation of state volume cap. Many of them probably won't. We're actually got none. So
what
it doesn't
do you
make
a state volume cap.
So the state has a limit set by the federal government how much bond authority they can go and issue each year. Because you don't want to allow folks to take out excessive amounts of debt, which is kind of surprising, given that we just hit $33 trillion
yeah.
of debt. But there's a limit to it. And the amount of state volume cap, if you will, gets divided into a bunch of different pots. One pot used for schools, one pot used for economic development projects, one is used for healthcare and hospitals, one part is used for housing, affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, but there's limits again on how much debt can be issued using this particular tool. There used to be that particular category used to not be very well subscribed to, meaning that there was always anyone to bring a deal forward was virtually assured of getting that the ability to do that. But now it's become super competitive. So you submit and it's a lottery, and only a certain number of deals on there out of the lottery. And we expect this year's lottery to be heavily subscribed. So all of these deals are going to come back to you. All of these deals have to get multiple approvals. So I would suggest that we perhaps handle them either in block and get your approval to submit to the lottery board, and then we see what comes back. Maybe be the detailed breakup. As a way to perhaps answer that today's GA's five deals were all deals with partners that we've done deals with in the past.
Right.
All have a proven track record of success, all in areas that are of high opportunity or where we should be investing in and that we feel good about, and all of our deals that meet your expectations of safety and hit the objectives that were identified on the city's blueprint and strategies.
I do have a question about all of them. I'm not familiar with April House.
So April is the old AIG.
It maybe came before us before, but I don't know.
So, there's this Park at Summers Grove.
Yes, there are partners at Park at Summers Grove. They're a subsidiary of a larger Blackstone. Able Housing is one of the largest housing, affordable housing providers in the country. They have 90,000 units. Very, 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 very social driven and passionate about their mission.
They're all for not
50%, or you know,
their average is 60% AMI.
They average 60% AMI. All of the three deals that we're proposing are deals to pay home, acquiring AIG, this previous company, that they want to reposition and reduce and preserve the affordability for 30 years. Sun Marin AIG was a group out of California that did fourth housing tax credit deals way back. And they acquired their national portfolio. It's a large portfolio of theirs here in South and Central Texas.
So this April Housing is well known in Austin?
Yes.
Well known to all the other
cities.
Although, and their properties right now have very deep affordability, and this would allow us, if we were to get bond reservations, to go in and do some rehab. To make them even better properties and keep them
in the United States. Affordability
is there, that's like 30%. Well, the fact that what I'm looking at is focusing on seniors, I found it very interesting. You know, I have no problem with moving all of them. I just think quite a lot.
And their occupancies are in the 90%.
We could, this was the first time I remember seeing April. Is that correct?
It's yes.
Yeah, that's
I mean, where I was. I sent an email to them a couple, 3 days ago that said, we use April Housing. Because I didn't know that I thought I was the only one
No, you're correct. in our old partner, AIG, when they were acquired by April, April became our partner on the park at Summers Grove, and we've worked with them now for 6 years now.
But that's not the kind of thing that we would get or know.
Right.
Because it's basically just administrative.
It was just a pay gap. It didn't affect our
service. No. We're on the same page, Tyra.
We got a new group of people and a new battalion philosophy of how they operate. Right. They're very, very refreshing. April's, but their executive team is probably, I mean, some of the smartest females. It's, I think it's 11 females, maybe one male. It's very heavily female driven, and some of the smartest people. And they're very social oriented, so that's community impact for them. Anyway, they're great breakers. But again, you may not see this again because we may not get people.
And I wanted to give them kind of some.
We can discuss these with a group of them.
Each
one.
Right.
You can't
see?
I'm saying legally, if somebody wanted to move forward with a deal, somebody would come back and tell them that. Because the public wasn't heard it, but they were not on notice in terms of looking at your proof because you got to approve what it's supposed to.
Well, and we'll just read the resolution number.
Yeah, well, you can talk about this as long, but you got to
read
it. You got to vote on it.
I wanted to kind of give y'all a little bit of idea on the timing on this. The lottery will happen at the end of December. The allocations for the people that actually get the awards will happen in January and February. So a closing for these transactions wouldn't happen until like 6 months later. So you would see these at least 2 to 3 times.
If we're lucky, the earliest we can look at is probably third quarter of 2021.
I'm not sure we have more.
I just wanted to talking about what the market is now, you know, closing these would be, you know.
These are not something you're going to see next month or next month.
The deadline for the lottery is in October, so that's why.
That's why you have so many of them, because we have to get them in by October 19th or 20th. It's the deadline.
Are they still, do they still build the waiting list?
So even though we don't get
lottery
number initially, there's a possibility throughout the year
it could get reached later.
In fact, I will be bringing up one in November that we were on the waiting list
for a long time. And
I'm glad y'all said that, explained the process, because I know Chuck was just thinking we're about to prove over 100 million dollars.
I think we should block.
We don't want to be challenged.
At least you only have to see them once. I'm not making you do it on AHC and PACA.
We got our lawyer here that can say King Sex.
And our commitment is not that great. All we're doing is asking
to get a good allocation, if we decided we didn't want to go forward, we would have to
see the application.
Is it a
$5,000? Okay, so we're going to spend a little money.
Well, we're not.
We're not
the part of us.
Better and better.
Chuck has a question. No, I'm still thinking of giving it a lot. Because we do that deal, we go back a lot of used to do it.
Yeah,
okay.
By the time we had this discussion, we could have already gone through these.
Yeah, I'm just leery. Given that you've got this type of money involved.
Okay. Mr. Gerber is going to let me chair this part of the meeting.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Okay. This is item number 2 on the agenda for the Austin Affordable ESC, and it is to approve resolution 00105. Declaring intent to issue bonds to finance multifamily residential rental development for persons of low and moderate income. Cameron Highline Apartments, and this is to give the staff permission to put an application in and bond with people.
So moved.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Place when I went through here that had the 30%, you know, the 30% and the 50%, because that was certainly one of the things that we struggled with.
Exactly.
And as we see the presentation today, you know, it's where the breaks needed. All right, item number 3, which is resolution 00106, same action, the ability to put an application in to the bond review board. This will be for the Elm Creek Apartments.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Item number 4 is resolution 00107 to approve the intent to issue bonds to credit financing for multifamily rental development. And this is the Heritage Point Seniors Apartments.
So moved.
More, and all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Who's in?
Thank you. There's Mary and Amy. Item number 5 on the Austin Affordable PFC agenda is resolution 00108. This is the intent to issue bonds to provide financing. Put an application in the Texas Bond Review Board, and this is for the Eagles Landing Family Apartments, and they are located at 8000 Decker Lane. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Question.
Rich can have to start one.
This zip code 78724 in the Austin 2-mile extraterritorial jurisdiction. I don't think that's. So we have a certain perimeter outside of the Austin city limits that goes.
We're allowed to be in the city itself.
Right.
And 5 miles out of what's called the extraterritorial
jurisdiction.
5 miles.
Yeah. So EJ is a 5 miles.
Every city has that, or is this just
every city?
Okay. Later on, because of that, for the IRS type of hearing, you'll have to get approval from the city and the county when you're in that
overlap.
We've done that before.
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
All right. Thank you. Last item is item number 6, which is resolution 00109. Again, intent to issue bonds for multifamily residential rental development. The name of this development is the Village at Collingwood Apartments.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Referring that to those company hall and the chief.
Adjourn this meeting. What's going to happen, Ron and Suzanne, if we end up in it all?
I'll be a little bit.
It's a great problem. That would be easy to know. We'll be talking about how we're building capital stacks and financing. Bonds.
But it could be the markets and other forces that are on the side, whether or not we can do it. I think if we're lucky, we expect to see it too.
When a lot of that comes before, when the first time I looked down and saw 158. All the things you were talking about, cost of construction. Is it cost of construction? We were building back in the day, we were building $26,000 for. Now we're at probably in between $250,000 cost. Land costs have gone up.
Materials.
Labor.
For sure. Really. Okay.
Wait till we get you into the executive session a little bit. We're going to talk to you about the plan, what's going on. Is that what we want to catch up by? So, everything's going up. Inflation, pressure to the front of the ground, taxes have been up.
The rents have been able to keep up with that in the most part and in the market. Slow down, but it's all numbers being.
That's why we've been our partners so hard. Because we want to be
able to get down to the road. So,
the debt, you're getting the credits are equity that we're not putting in the company. And you're talking about max, probably we'll start thinking it's number 60 million for property.
Yeah.
So the value of those are even far exceeded.
And you told me that before,
but it has to be certain DCR coverages. You get so many eyes on these deals.
It's all non-recourse debt.
It's all non-recourse debt.
So if God forbid one of these deals went under, there's 18 other entities that are involved, but the main investor is the entity that's left really kind of responsible for the house that they're
right. And we don't give you the guarantees.
We provide no guarantees. And those other investors put so much work in to make sure their investment is safe before they even commit to us. And, we're working with large institutions that have a lot of debt.
We feel pretty.
And the tax credit stock is a little different than the other because we hold on to those. Yeah. You go in there as a developer knowing that you're more than likely to stay there.
The property pays the debt, and so if they were going to, if they were having trouble, they would probably have to sell their LP, their partnership interest to somebody else on the side that would affect us with the property.
Yeah,
the property services the debt, services all that. We see recaps all the time. You see one fund moving out of another fund. So that's doable. They're isolated funds, so it's not like company dollars, I should say. I mean, there's a certain amount of fund raised, that capital is expended, and then it stays, and that fund closes, and they open up another one. So, the risk is fairly minimal. As long as you're smart
about
that. And my affiliation before any of this question comes. If my knowledge is right, less than 1% of all the tax issues since the inception of 1986 has failed. Less than 1%. Since 1986.
That's correct.
check the territory.
It's, well, I'm pretty comfortable. I just, every time I think you're real comfortable, on the there's something you haven't thought about.
Yeah, that's always the case that somebody can get the certification done.
It's
always the case, but yeah, it is pretty very tight.
Well, and we also create a single purpose entity for our general partner entity, so that insulates us a little bit more.
Keep in mind, if a project is working without a tax exemption, it certainly is going to work with paying taxes. So the investor / lender or that mortgage company is going to come back to us and say, we may kick the limited partner out because they failed, but we need you to steal and rework on something because they failed all those things. And it kind of gives us more of a compensation too.
Anything else for the Public Facility Corporation before I close the meeting?
I'll make a motion.
Any more discussion? All those in favor?
I do have to say one thing. We are in the process of closing Katie Moss, which we brought to you for a lesson. And Sarah's been like my savior. Every call I've been on, Sarah's backstop. And it's been a very difficult deal, but grace of God, we will have it closed.
Today.
Well, and I noticed that T-Chat is doing a day and a half for a workshop on payment support nets.
Oh, yeah.
So,
okay, so we have a motion and a second. I think we've been voted. And so the meeting is adjourned at 2:30 on Thursday, September
20th.
So, Richie, you get that. So, Commissioner, go back to the main topic. Item number 3 is a quick update on the redevelopment of Santa Rita. And yes, just very quickly. Give you an update on where we are on the Santa Rita design. You know, Rose was under active construction. You've seen the results here. We're keeping the momentum moving. The next stop is Santa Rita, and after the construction starts on Santa Rita, we think the next stop after that will be like that. So we're going to just keep working our way through our challenge properties and redevelopment. Anyway, give a quick update on where we are in terms of the redesign.
Absolutely. I won't spend too much time writing about Santa Rita today. We've done Palmer's, we've done Redwood. We know systems are antiquated, no air conditioning, small spaces, limited industrial. The work needs to be done. So we have begun talking to stakeholders. That's what we've been doing since January. We've had our first resident meeting in January. We held 5 tranches of resident meetings. Community meetings, we've spoken to the City of Austin Community Development Commission, Hispanic Latino Quality of Life, La Raza Roundtable, we've had general community meetings, we've had live meetings, we've had Zoom meetings, we've been at outdoor festivals, we were in Austin just last weekend, putting out surveys, putting out giving presentations, asking for feedback on what the community, residents, outside stakeholders want to see in the redevelopment area. So first and foremost, residents. We've had, of 97 units at Santa Arena, we've had 64 residents attend some meeting. That's not a bad response rate. We get to a point where we talk to everyone, but for just as information gathering stage, not a bad response rate. This is the most recent survey that we took. This is what you want to see in a redevelopment. Those 5 biggest number is AC. Also, everything we've heard before, washer dryers, playground improvements, security, better parking, bigger rooms. This is what we've been hearing from what we've heard from Chalmers, what we've heard at Rosewood, and the same thing we're hearing at Santa Rita. The community. has been very loud about wanting more affordable housing, having heard the presentations today, no surprise, particularly for housing for families, 2, 3, and 4 bedrooms. There's something that they always ask about resident relocation. They always ask about what's going to happen to the current families. We have a great track record here at Chalmers and at Rosewood. We treat our residents well. We take care of them during relocation. For the first time, we're hearing consistent requests for green building, climate resilient housing. That's been loud and clear at all the community meetings. There's requests for us helping to address street parking, and then questions about amenities, what kind of services are we providing. Childcare has come up quite a few times. So that's something we have heard in earlier feedback. So we've got a lot going on as far as outreach. We're trying to reach as many people as we can. We're working with Saldana Public Relations. Paul Saldana is very well-known in East Austin. We've created a Friends at Santa Rita mailing list. We've got a live survey out now. So all of these meetings since January, all these meetings we've been having have been taking us where we are today. Here is Santa Rita.
How many units?
As we sit today.
97. Tell us this, but how many units?
Sorry, 97 right now. 97 units. On the right-hand side in orange are what we call the bungalows. Those were the original units that were built in 1939. We've got a picture of LBJ sitting on the step of one of them. And this is on the National Register of Historic Places as the first affordable housing in the country to open. The white buildings to the left, to the west, those were built in a second phase in the early 50s. They are not on the register. Of the National Register. And then this also illustrates some of the other trees that we'll have to construction. All those dark green trees are heritage trees. We leave them or we spend a lot of money to move them. We can't cut them down. And you can also see highlighted in teal there, we've got an old sewer system running under the property. So these are all going to be the challenges that our architects and our engineers are going to have to overcome as they think about what to do with Santa Rita. So, we've talked to residents, we've talked to the community, we've got our architect, our engineers working on it, got a couple of potential site plans that I want to show you today. And with each one, I want to highlight a few things. You guys don't mind, I'm going to come up here and stand so I can point. So, I know this is hard to see. This site plan is 248 units. Couple of things I want to point out here. One is the location of the preservation. So as I mentioned, we're on the National Register of Historic Places. We think we will be able to do some demolition of the units on the east side, those bungalow units, those historic units. We have been gathering community feedback. We've been talking with the State Historic Preservation Office to figure out what that number is going to be like. So all of that, understanding all that context, and we are ultimately going to have to come to an agreement there. This is one scenario where we keep these 5 buildings as residential units. So we would, as they are at Rosewood, scoop out the inside, go back with completely new fixtures. Everything looks brand new inside. Accessibility, everything's brand new. The outside looks similar to what it looks like today. You may remember that at Rosewood, we are going all the way back to 1939. We are doing historically accurate restoration. That's very expensive. We're spending at least 50% more on those Rosewood restoration units than we are on brand new units. So we're hoping maybe we won't have to go quite to that level of preservation at Santa Rita. That remains to be seen. But again, this scenario, we've got the preservation here. This is also a preserved building. What our architects are envisioning here is that this is almost like a gazebo. Where they scoop out the inside and you can see through it. But it can be kind of like the area that we have out here with the covered deck, something along those lines, a community gathering space. Because like Rosewood, we will need to have some kind of recognition of the legacy of Santa Rita Courts. That's very important to us, very important to residents in the community. So this would be that commemorative space. What goes in it, something we'll continue to work on, but this would be that commemorative space. The other thing I want to point out here is the layout of the other buildings. We've got a brand new building here, 3 stories. Brand new building here, 3 stories. And then here in the middle, we're proposing 4 stories.
Second Street is on its way. There are some single family homes here now. It is, we think, in the future, and we know from some rezoning action that's taking place, this is becoming commercial. This is very solidly residential. This is Christo Rey Catholic Church is over here. There's some other smaller buildings here. And Pedernales is solidly residential. So the four stories pushing up against Second Street seems to make a little more sense. And then back here, you can see we've got parking. So these four-story buildings aren't right up against these single-family homes. So this, and the other thing is, we've got two courtyards here, two small courtyards, and a one-story amenity building. So that's the features of this one. This second one's a little bit different. Preservation is here in the middle. Still saving this building here, but we've got four residential buildings, new construction, three-story on each side. Again, four stories here, but this has a big central courtyard rather than two smaller courtyards, and still three stories here, still parking primarily along Santa Rita, although we do push this building a little closer, whereas the first iteration we had parking. These are the two site plans we have been shopping around over the past 2 months to residents and community members to get feedback. Generally, the feedback has been positive. We haven't gotten a lot of strong feelings about this versus this preservation aspect versus this preservation aspect. We have had some spirited discussions about density with the community. Some people are very in favor, much, much more density than we want to use. We've even heard or proposing here. Most are happy with the density level that we're talking about here.
There has not been the push on this for preservation. The only ones pushing it seem to be the state historic preservation office. And that's it.
So, and maybe preservation office. Yeah.
So we may come back and less preservation because frankly the costs are so high in the mayor community. It's more good.
So one of the bullet points I saw that the community wanted was daycare shop care facilities. If you give us a limited space you got here, but if you could do more density, would you do it if so?
If we could do more dense housing, we absolutely could do more density. So we could go up to four stories here. We could go up to four stories here. As a matter of fact, a little farther down the presentation, I will show you. We could go up to 70 feet if we wanted to. We could go up to 70 feet right up to the edge of the building.
Well, no, I mean, where I'm getting going with this is in terms of the child care facility, you put one on the side.
And do you have that one up there?
Where?
In answer to your question,
okay.
This is the latest, came out this morning. This envisions potentially putting a child care center over here on the far west side. So it would be residential here. And then a single story of the child care facility here, which, and again, this is hot off the presses, so we're still working through this. And then this could be the space that the child care center uses, the outdoor area. So we're absolutely thinking about this. There are a couple, partner opportunities. You know, we have Main Spring Schools at Meadowbrook. Bezos Academy has been expanding their presence with child care. So we've got, that's why it's actually a good space to cut it. The idea here is this could be a potential location for a child care center. This still allows us 255 minutes. As we work through the financing, which is challenging, it's very challenging. We've heard about how hard it is to do deals now. 250 seems to be the sweet spot, in this. I'll go quickly through this. This is what they call a massing study. So this is looking, this is Second Street, this is Pedernales. So this is building from the southeast. So this is one scenario. So the preservation buildings are here. And then you can just kind of see how this would sit in the neighborhood. And then just the other is with the preservation here in the middle. Three stories, four stories, three stories. This is kind of give you an idea of how it would sit in the neighborhood here. So looking at funding sources, so I talked about 250 units being the sweet spot. That is with two separate deals.
So what we're envisioning now as we work through this process is a 9% competitive tax credits, which is what we did here at Chalmers East, what we did at Chalmers West. We're also looking at a second deal with 4% tax credits and bonds. That's what we did at Chalmers South and what we did at Rosewood. They both have pros and cons, different ways of funding, different amounts of funding. Right now we're looking at doing them both in two separate deals. There's also federal and state historic tax credits. There's a HUD green and resilient retrofit grant that's out right now that could provide us the money for some green stuff, and the Inflation Reduction Act has a clean energy tax credit that nonprofits are now allowed to take advantage of, yes.
So going back to your schematics, could you do solar and get solar money?
Yes. So we have done solar at every redevelopment we've done. If you look at these buildings in the sky, you see solar panels everywhere. And we plan to do it at Rose. We absolutely plan to do it here. What we're hearing from the community is they want to go further. And the Green and Resilient Retrofit Program, for example, this is a new HUD grant. It's only for PDRA properties, which is the assistance that we have here. And in a nutshell, what it allows for is if you're putting something in, they pay to green it. So if you're putting in a regular washer, they pay the extra for the energy efficient. If you're putting in a roof, they pay for it to be a green roof. That's in the very most basic terms, that's what that money would give us. There's a lot of strings here. A lot of strings, a lot of compliance, a lot of hoops to jump through. We don't even know if we're eligible for all of this funding. But as Ron was saying, interest rates are going up, cost of construction is going up. Compared to what we did at Chalmers South 6 years ago when we closed that deal, to what we can do now, it's just the landscape has changed so much. So we're going to have to look at all of these different funding sources. And RODA, the Rental Housing Development Assistance, the city money that Mandy brought up.
But with the Inflation Reduction Act, $700 million targeted just for Texas,
mm-hmm.
and a portion of that is targeted for low-income communities. And so that's what I'm wondering, is there a way to sort of offset some of those costs with the money that EPA wants to give away?
Yeah, well, so interestingly, separate from this, we're actually working, Jimmy Teasdale and I met, and Ron met week before last, with Tim Harvey, who's in charge of the solar program at Austin Energy. They are working with several other large cities in Texas to put it in a proposal. And, oh gosh, $60 million is what they're asking for Austin. And a good bit of that is trying, it's the Solar for All program, trying to get solar to all the income levels. So, I could come back with more details about that. I don't have them all in my head. But they have asked if HACA and AAHC would be willing to participate. And we talked a little bit through some of the broad strokes of the program. The answer was a resounding yes. I mean, there again, lots of strings and lots of logistics to work through. But yes, Austin Energy has involved us in that. And that's not just this project, that's all of our portfolio and all of our support.
Good. Because I'm kind of familiar with the work. The guys who are putting together the proposal are putting it together, but they don't have the specifics. So they really are looking for specific projects.
Yeah.
Because the proposal to get funded, and it can't be we're just going to spend money in low-income areas. What are the specific projects?
And what they've asked us for at this point is just a letter of support. We haven't even seen the letter yet, but that's what they're saying, is that just kind of letter of interest saying, yes, we generally want to be involved.
Because
in
the letter really goes to supporting them because they're competing with other groups to get the funding. They'll need to have to identify projects in order to get the funding.
Yeah, which is exciting. So, our timeline. I can't believe 2023 is almost over. We have spent 2023 in our planning design phase. We have a tax credit application. The pre-application for the 9% tax credits is due in January. The full application is due in March. For that application, we have to commit to a site plan and a number of units. We have very little wiggle room after we put in that application. So that's why we've spent so much time specifically talking about number of units and site plan. Because once we go put down what we want to do, we can't deviate from that. And part of that is this demolition and the bungalow units. So we're spending a lot of time working through this because we can't change that if we've committed. So
2023 planning and design, 2024 those applications for funding. We will be joining the lottery that Ron and Suzanne are in right now. So the 9% deal, the 9% tax credits doesn't have to use those bonds. The 4% tax credits will. So we'll be in the lottery. So we'll be in the same thing waiting for our number to pop up. If it does, this will move along all in one, we hope, generally in one process. If not, it maybe this is two-phase, more like Chalmers's. So still working through all those details, but ultimately, if all goes as planned and we get the 9% award, which is certainly not guaranteed, it's very competitive, then construction would start and the location would start construction.
And when will we bring back the request to apply to the bonding board for 5 cap?
For the bonds. That's it. The first thing they're going to say that the board will see is the 9% application.
And that'll come to December?
December, January.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
Any questions?
I don't have anything.
Yes, this is Jeff Patterson and Damian Martinez put this together for us with working with Lupe. And I got to do a shout out to Lupe, y'all. She has been amazing. Mary has been as well in coming to our community meetings, coming to all of our resident meetings, and supporting our message, supporting the residents, and really helping us to keep this moving. Not here, but all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last item, I think, is further put that up inside of 2014 and whatever. For approving the resident contact for landlords and staff lead services. We routinely approve different
not doing the
work.
I'll do that for
you. The toilet,
that PowerPoint you said.
Set back to that work. Family issues, his parents, and Coconut stepped up to work. Coconut's done a good job. Arthur came back into the work, and so we're splitting up our work between Coconut and Coilo, and then there's a third firm that offers some benefits as well. And we're seeing a lot of our work, and no one's firm is going to be able to sort of follow it. But the third firm based in Dallas, and it's kind of lost this great firm.
This is Felton, one of the associates, a small firm. A lot of conversations with him. Verifying the location and travel and everything, that's not going to be something that can be charged to us. That's the commitment to be present.
We need to decide how the work is planned. We can really support the partners of them for a better use of them. Three strong firms that can assist us, and Arthur and Coconuts remaining in the
majority of the So it's him and one other person. They've done some work with the Dallas Housing Authority and other entities, other private entities, and the like.
We had
19 entities download and review the RFP, and 3 submitted responses.
So we would ask your approval for the 2014 the racial diversity executive session, which I hope will be short. The board will go into executive session pursuant to Texas Government Code 551.471, the compensation of attorneys around New York Life from the Council of Litigation for selling off for 551.72. About discussion, purchase, exchange, lease, or value of real estate. 551.074, discuss the appointment, valuation, assignment duties.
First time heard of it.
551.071,
so we can hear. So we can hear.
maybe a key okay and
you missed 12 minutes in the second half. It's recording again. Yeah, I paused it here.
Sustainable rad rents. And we've been very actively advocating the HUD to provide some financial relief and increase these rental rents. And unfortunately, you know, it just goes without bureaucracy. I know the Board of Governors, Trudeau, has adopted that as a policy priority. And I am working through CLAPA on a working group that's dedicated to this issue. And it's not just something that's happening to Austin, it's happening to everyone.
And we actually got an RV to get our board direction approved in resolution version. Basically, fair market rent equity for first property of rent properties. And so, yeah, from a Washington perspective, so if we can't get a resident to this directly, we're just on the paper that we can stay readings of, or any legislate the effects of the there's enough of a coalition there to get lots to work on, but just see if we had to do more work through those levels. Many of the properties cash flow, but the number down won't because of the increased salaries and increased costs. We're seeing insurance costs involved and other costs have gone up. So
salary and benefits, because we were, as you know, having a really, really tough time filling our maintenance positions, our assistant manager positions. We were going months and months without even one application being submitted. So we have to compete in this job market, and that's what we your approval to increase the starting pay of $20 an hour. But of course, that gets, you know, impacted on the property on many ways.
Is that our ability to hire these members?
How long have we been doing it? And was it April? That it went into effect this year. So again, it'll impact the property budgets that will come before you.
Do we need to have some conversations about the fact that nobody is talking union benefits? Is that do we need to have a conversation in terms of the projecting what might have to happen in the next 2 or 5 years?
Well, I think we're trying to work with our partners at Gallagher to create a benefit framework. Track employees, but it's not one that's going to bring them back. Some cutbacks in our healthcare, sort of using costs and whatnot. The benefits I don't think we're this to the organization or
that's the environment.
Yeah,
it's right. It's not everybody's fine with the new guys.
Well, I think
I don't
friends of it. Yeah. I mean, places that get unionized, they end up it's real challenges. I think we do a good job of just our folks. Sort of trying to address the housing piece would be one thing that I think could be really helpful.
Yeah, that's what I've been interested in the conversation. But what can you offer? And also, you still want to be a leader, it seems to me, in the sole direction, offering fair wages.
We're keeping pace with the county, with the city. I think it's also great that we try to provide as much flexibility with hybrid work policies. But I think, to your point, Commissioner, if there was a way that we could find some method to assist our more entry level to mid range employees for some housing assistance. I think that would go along with that.
Frankly, possible IT, you know, IT people is just really scary. Mr. So we'll come back to you at next board meeting with that pre-meeting. So plan for 10:30 to 11:45 for those who can't recover.
Fire
alarm.
We're
in a world of hurt if we
can do that. I'm glad we have the best in the business because just wake up every day and,
once every other week, you can read the story about housing. Yeah. So far, I was just adjourning to take a walk across the street to the
Do you need the
leader stuff here? Do you need your stuff here and then come right back over? Or we just don't walk literally across the street.
So, let's take a motion to adjourn.
It is 3:30.
September 21st.